Interesting angle. Please DM me on Facebook if you're willing to give specifics. I realized that the reply had come from the author of the original blog post. She had asked Deb for a direct message, a private email, looking for the details of my background, which apparently might provide another layer to Jason's story. "The pink spot?" I said aloud. "It's like a snarky chick website, fake feminism, if you ask me. How did my kid know all this?" "It's fine, Spencer. It would take access to police reports to figure out exactly where I had been for those 3 years, and even those wouldn't contain all the facts. Don't worry about it, okay?" I could tell he was thinking about saying more, but then he flashed a toothy grin over the back of the sofa. "Hey, Mom, can you explain to me why it's called the pink spot? Because I don't understand. You're trying to put me in the grave, aren't you?" "Don't kill me, but you totally sounded like Grandma right then." He was back on his screen again, looking at something that had nothing to do with me. 21. Carrie Lynch answered the door in her work clothes, but she was holding a nearly empty wine glass, a small, fluffy white dog circling her bare feet. "Cute little girl," Corinne said. "Boy, actually, but yeah, he's a sweetie. Aren't you, Snowball? I spoil him like crazy to make up for the fact that I'm never home. Sorry you have a shitty mommy, baby." Carrie had sounded so shaken when she called that Corinne drove all the way out to Port Washington to take her report. In truth, she could also use the overtime. When Corinne was standing in Powell's foyer the previous evening, she'd seen the family photographs adorning the walls. Powell with his wife, and a boy who went from missing two front teeth to a tall, lanky tween. Now that she was seeing Carrie Lynch in person again, Corinne realized that Carrie looked nothing like Powell's wife superficially. Carrie was thin and pale, with blade straight shoulder-length dark hair. Angela was curvier, with long, dark blonde waves. But both women had strong, angular features, almost mannish if they hadn't been so naturally beautiful. Patrician is what Corinne thought people might call the look. Corinne followed as Carrie went to the kitchen and grabbed an open bottle of wine from the counter. She offered Corinne a glass, which she declined, and then headed back to the living room and gave herself a generous refill. The entire house was meticulous. "Even after what Jason did to me, I heard a side of him on the phone this morning that terrified me. I think I made a mistake going to you. I know this won't be much comfort, but I have never had an offender follow through on verbal threats to a witness. If they mean to do you harm, they don't announce their plans in advance." "You're right, that was definitely not comforting," Carrie said with a sad smile. She patted the spot next to her on the sofa, and Snowball eagerly jumped up. Corinne wasn't about to tell Carrie that the road ahead of her would be easy. She would be on trial as much as Jason Powell. At least the case against him was beginning to shape up. She told Carrie about the surveillance video she had gotten from the W Hotel and the call records they'd requested, which should corroborate the fact that he'd phoned her again that morning. "ADA King will apply for a warrant for a DNA swab from Jason tomorrow." "He hasn't done that yet? I assumed it was off at the lab already. He wanted to fill out the investigation a bit more first." "I gave you pictures and physical evidence. You've got that other woman's story, too. What more do you need?" "I know it's frustrating, but lawyers like to go in a certain order." "Well, I can tell you right now that DNA is going to be a match. Jason's going to say it was consensual, and it will be my word against his." "Actually, we already got a statement from him. He denied any kind of sexual relationship." Carrie shook her head angrily and took another huge sip of wine. Corinne had seen this reaction before. Victims fully expected the perpetrators to depict them as willing participants. They braced themselves to be blamed. But for him to deny the encounter altogether was even more demeaning. If it never happened, it means absolutely nothing. "Trust me, Carrie, that's actually good news. When the DNA matches, we'll have him trapped in a lie. Plus, we have photos of the marks on your wrists, and the footage from the hotel is helpful. It's clear you were making him leave your room." "But I didn't call the police. I didn't come forward until Rachel complained, and I continued to work with him in the meantime. I even met with him this week, here, in my house, alone." She pulled her dog onto her lap. "He can say whatever he wants. Then how will I prove he's lying?" "If anything," Corinne said, "the fact that he met you at your house conflicts with his story that nothing unusual ever occurred between the two of you." Corinne was putting the best light on this particular fact. She happened to know that ADA King was troubled by Carrie's decision to meet Jason at her home instead of in a public place. "So when will he get charged?" Carrie asked. "My guess is that King will want you to go before a grand jury once the DNA results are back. Please hang in there, okay? Carrie nodded. Corinne had done her job, for now, keeping the complainant on board. There's something else you should know, Carrie said, because it's going to come out, I know it. A different detective would have told her that it really wasn't necessary. Once Jason was charged, anything Carrie said to undermine the pending case would eventually become so-called Brady material, potentially exculpatory evidence that had to be disclosed to the defense. Corinne said nothing, and Carrie continued. 3 years ago, I had an affair with Tom Fisher, the CEO of Oasis, my company. He was married, his wife read the texts. We got caught. People at work know. They might assume I was at it again, having an affair with a man I met at work. That's part of the reason I didn't say anything when it first happened. Did you have an affair with Jason Powell? No, of course not. Then I don't see what a relationship you had with Mr. Fisher 3 years ago has to do with any of this, okay? Carrie looked relieved. She hugged Corinne at the front door and thanked her before saying goodbye. 22. An inch-thick stack of call records arrived for Corinne the following morning. The Powell home had no landline, but AT&T had sent logs for Jason Powell's cell number as well as the other cell phones on the same account. She set aside the two extra logs, presumably for the wife and kid, and focused on Jason's. The subpoena covered the last 2 months, about 2 weeks prior to Carrie's assault, running all the way up until yesterday. She made a photocopy first and then began highlighting every appearance of Carrie's number. As Carrie had said, they tended to speak 2 or 3 times a week, both before and after the incident. Other numbers for Oasis employees appeared on the log, too. Corinne placed check marks next to the two most recent calls from Jason to Carrie. The first was on the day the Post had broken the news of Rachel Sutton's complaint. According to Carrie, this was when Jason insisted on seeing her in person before offering to pay her off to sign a non-disclosure agreement. The second appeared yesterday morning, when Carrie claimed Jason had threatened to kill her if she followed through with prosecution. King had wanted to show a judge they weren't cutting corners. What she saw here was good enough to do the job. She called King and gave him a quick summary. I'll scan and email the relevant pages to you.
Sounds good.
So you're getting the warrant?
Let me look at everything once it's all put together.
Are you kidding me?
I'm just being thorough.
No, being thorough was getting the phone records, the hotel videos, and a statement from Powell. You have more than enough for probable cause.
Not your call, Duncan.
Seriously? Once Corinne had sent the relevant pages to King, she flipped through the rest of the call records, looking for any patterns that stood out. The most frequent calls by all three members of the Powell family were to one another. Jason's account had the most activity by far, as would be expected given his work. She assumed that the next busiest, with calls made during school hours, was the wife's. The son's phone was barely used at all. No surprise there. For kids these days, a phone call was as outdated as a telegraph. She paid special attention to calls made after the news of Rachel's complaint broke. Using Google, she identified two frequent callers as Jason's lawyer, Olivia Randall, and another attorney named Colin Harris. She didn't see anything else that might relate to the case. She was about to file the records away when her eyes flashed on an incoming call 4 days ago to what Corinne assumed was the wife's cell. It was a 631 area code. Suffolk County, on Long Island, the East End. It was only 6 seconds long, maybe a wrong number. But something about the phone number seemed familiar. Corinne looked at the phone on her desk and pictured the pattern of the digits on the dial pad. When she remembered a number, it was usually a combination of both the actual numbers and the shape they made on a phone. That's why this one felt familiar. The 631 area code plus the next three digits, 796, formed a perfect square. Nothing about the next four digits rang a bell. Now the square-shaped combination of six numbers was burrowed in her brain, and she knew she wouldn't be able to let go of them until she figured out where she'd seen them before. She pulled out her cell phone and scrolled through her recent calls, searching for the 631 area code. Nothing. She knew that iPhones physically retained information for the last 1,000 calls, but only displayed the most recent 100. For Corinne, that was only a few days. She began deleting calls from her history to make room for older records. This was the kind of thing her ex used to call her OCD. Like a dog with a bone, he'd say, shaking his head. She finally found it 5 days back. 4 calls in total. Now she remembered. She needed background information on a rape suspect who'd previously been accused of stalking a woman he met on summer vacation. The calls had been to a detective in the East Hampton Police Department. She used her computer to look up the general number for the department. Same area code, same prefix, different extension. She wasn't quite ready to drop the bone yet. She pulled up the driver's license record for Angela Powell, showing a name change 6 years ago from Angela Mullen. She searched state police records and found a missing persons report from 15 years ago. She did a check against the date of birth. Angela would have been only 16 years old. She saw another entry showing the report cleared 3 years later. She picked up her phone and dialed the now memorized square of 6 numbers, followed by the last 4 digits of the number from Angela Powell's phone record. The voice was gruff, older.
Hendrix.
This is Detective Corinne Duncan with NYPD Special Victims Unit. I was hoping to talk to you about Angela Powell, a.k.a. Angela Mullen. There was a pause on the other end of the line, followed by a heavy sigh.
I'd like to help her out, but I don't actually know the husband.
He wanted to help her, Angela, out, not you, a fellow detective. Corinne was certain she hadn't misheard. But you know why I'm calling, she said.
Well, I know her husband was in the news about an intern. You ask me, that case sounds like a big bag of nothing, but of course you know more than what's in the papers. I assume you're calling about Franklin, but I don't think the family wants me talking about it. Her dad made Harbor Grill turn off a Steelers game one time with no explanation. That's how bad they wanted Pittsburgh wiped from the map. Tell you what, if I get her permission, I'll give you a call, all right? Otherwise, police reports are all you're going to get.
Fair enough, Corinne said and hung up. Googling Franklin together with Pittsburgh brought up a borough named Franklin, followed by dozens of listings for various businesses. She tried again, adding the names Angela Powell and then Angela Mullen into the search. Nothing. She tried Franklin, Pittsburgh, missing girl. Even before she hit the enter key, the connection was beginning to come to her. Holy shit. She actually said the words out loud when she saw the results. She checked the dates of Angela Mullen's missing persons report and the date it was cleared. It all fit. Charles Franklin. She wouldn't have remembered the name off the top of her head, but the case was plastered across the news for a few days when it went down. A neighbor kept hearing a baby from Franklin's house, even though Franklin, a quiet contractor, lived all alone, as far as anyone knew. When the neighbor asked him about it, he told her it was the television, but she had never heard television noise from another house before. Suddenly, the few times she had seen his nieces visiting the house took a darker turn, so she called the police to be safe. That phone call set in motion the discovery of a chilling scene inside the house, followed by a 3-day manhunt. The Pittsburgh Police Department sent out one officer, alone, to do a knock and talk at the house. He was knocking for a third time and about to give up when the garage door opened and Franklin's white Lexus SUV reversed from the driveway at high speed and took off down the street. Inside the house, the police found an upstairs bedroom with an interior brick wall erected just inside the window. From the outside, the neighbors saw curtains and darkness. The occupants inside were barricaded with no light and a padlock on the door. The room contained 2 twin beds and a crib. From the appearance of dark blonde hair on one pillow and dark brown hair on the other, police concluded that at least 2 people, probably girls, slept there. And, of course, the baby. An APB went out for both Franklin and the SUV. 3 days later, a pair of hikers in Niagara Falls, New York, spotted a man carrying water toward a tent. After the wife heard the sound of a baby crying, she decided that the man resembled the picture she'd seen in a televised Amber Alert that morning as they were leaving the hotel. After checking the details on her phone, she was even more suspicious. She made her husband help her scour the parking areas until she found a white Lexus SUV with Pennsylvania plates, but the tag numbers didn't match the alert. The husband waved down a park ranger. Within minutes, it was confirmed. The plates had been switched, but the vehicle identification number on the dash was Franklin's. Corinne didn't know all the details of the attempted rescue, but she imagined helicopters and teams of officers in both uniform and plain clothes. What she did know from her quick scan of the news reports was that when police arrived, Franklin ran toward the tent instead of obeying police commands to stop and raise his hands. He was fatally shot. Police found a 19-year-old woman and her baby inside the tent. The woman said that Franklin had abducted her 3 years earlier. After she became pregnant, about a year after the kidnapping, he abducted a second, younger girl. The woman gave birth to the baby in the locked room upstairs. Then, 3 days prior to the rescue in Niagara Falls, Franklin suddenly ordered both of the girls to grab the baby and get into the SUV in the garage. As Franklin was backing out of the driveway, the two girls had pounded on the car windows from the back seat when they saw the police officer at the front door, but the doors were locked and they couldn't get out. Only the 19-year-old and the baby survived. After hearing the news alerts about the search for him and his vehicle too many times on the car radio, Franklin had pulled off I-90 in the dark, stopped near a body of water, presumed to be Lake Erie, shot the younger girl, and dumped her corpse in the water. When Franklin got back into the SUV, he commanded the remaining victim to look older or the same would happen to her. The police theorized that he killed the younger victim so they would not fit the description of a man traveling with two girls and a baby. As the older of the two victims, the survivor might be able to pass as his wife. Plus, she was the baby's mother. In short, he kept her and threw the other one away. What did any of this have to do with Jason Powell? Did his connection to Angela and her son make him a good person? Or was he a predator who recognized something vulnerable in her? Corinne's thoughts were interrupted by the sound of the phone. She recognized the number on the digital screen as the main switchboard for the district attorney's office. "Duncan," she answered.
"Hey, it's Brian."
"Hey." It took her a second to connect Brian to ADA King.
"Thanks for sending the phone records, and for driving out to Port Washington to talk to Carrie, and for getting a statement from Powell. It's good work."
He sounded different than usual, quieter, more contemplative. "Yeah, okay." Silence filled the line. She could tell that he didn't want to hang up. "Is this about the Martin case?" she asked. Robert Martin was an Academy Award-winning director who had been accused of raping a 23-year-old production assistant while his crew ignored the sounds of screams from his trailer. After a 4-week trial, the jury acquitted on all counts. He sighed.
"And the Santos case. And we may as well throw in Pratt and Isaacson while we're at it."
Santos was the cop accused of raping a woman he'd escorted home after her cab driver complained she was vomiting in the back seat. Pratt was the Columbia Law School student acquitted of raping a fellow student after the annual law review bash. Isaacson was the hedge fund guy whose rape case was pleaded down to a misdemeanor after the DA's office had its ass handed to it 4 days straight in trial. It had not been a good streak for the high-profile prosecutions of sex offenses in Manhattan. "This is a winnable case," Corinne said.
"Not good enough. I need a slam dunk."
"No such thing in this line of work."
"I should sell out to the man and defend polluters and Ponzi schemers."
"No, you shouldn't."
"Do you want to go to dinner?"
"I'm going to dinner, King, but not with you." She could picture him laughing at the other end of the line.
"Damn," he said.
She considered telling him what she had learned about Angela Powell, but she saw no connection between it and the case against her husband. "Talk to you later?"
"Yeah, but hey, I had a reason for calling other than feeling sorry for myself. I got the warrant signed for the DNA swab."
"Really?"
"I realized there were no more excuses for dragging my feet. Go big or go home, right? You'll drop it on him today?"
"Yep. Ready to go now, in fact."
"Sounds good."
As Corinne hung up the phone, her thoughts flashed to Angela Powell, who had once been Angela Mullen, at 18 years old, delivering her baby in a bricked-in room in Pittsburgh, an 8-hour drive from her parents. She couldn't imagine how that woman was going to feel when this DNA test was a match. 23. Heads turned as we passed tables at the 21 Club. I knew we should have gone somewhere low-key downtown, but Susanna had convinced me to meet her in Midtown, promising that her person would seat us in the back corner. Getting there had required walking through the dining room, accompanied by a woman whose face filled television screens all over America on a daily basis. "I'm not so sure about this," I muttered after the waiter had taken our orders. "Please." We walked by one person pending trial for mail fraud and another in the middle of a billion-dollar divorce. "I hate to break it to you, but this crowd has more than enough of its own problems to dwell on than your do-gooder husband." I was thankful that the tables to either side of us were empty. Except he's not the do-gooder anymore, is he? Now there's apparently another woman, and we have no idea what she may have said. I had given Susanna the rundown on Carrie Lynch when she called to check on me the previous night, and she'd insisted on taking me out to this lunch. I didn't hesitate to share everything I knew. She'd been my friend for 10 years now. No one other than my parents and Spencer had been a constant in my life for that long. When she first began treating me as her friend, and not just her caterer, I worried that maybe she already knew about me. I thought she might be working an angle to earn my trust. I began testing her, mentioning details about Spencer as a baby, wondering if she'd ask about his father. I even asked her once out of the blue whether she'd ever been to Pittsburgh, and she seemed completely confused by the question. She had no idea that I was anyone other than a young mom from the South Fork who cooked good food and needed a friend. When I decided to tell Susanna that I was the girl rescued from Charles Franklin, my parents thought I was insane to trust a journalist of all people. But Susanna was almost like a surrogate mother. After everything she had done for me, I wanted her to really know me. She cried when I told her and said she was sorry I was carrying that on my own. A couple of times she asked me if I was sure I wouldn't be happier if I told my story to the world. I can make enough money to move out of my parents' house. I told her the same thing I would later tell Jason. I didn't want my story to be public, and it didn't seem right to make money off it anyway. And when I told her I didn't want to write a book or give an interview or go to the therapy she offered to pay for, all she asked was to let her know if I ever changed my mind. She never leaked a word. When it came to me, she respected an impenetrable wall between her job and our friendship. Now, over lunch, she was trying to reassure me that everything was going to be all right. I know it's verboten to say, but women do lie about these things. She had lowered her voice, even though we weren't within earshot of anyone else. You're going to have to give back your sisterhood card if someone hears you, Susanna. You know what they say, there's a special place in hell for women who don't support other women. I had told her about the police coming to the house, asking Jason if he'd ever had sex with a woman named Carrie Lynch. She agreed with me that it sounded like Carrie had leveled a new accusation, and because of the question about sexual relations, it had to be more serious than Rachel's initial claim. Look, I get it, Susanna said, tucking her chin-length, perfectly frosted bob behind one ear. I'm always the one saying that when it's he said, she said, I'll pick the woman every time, because 99% of the time, women are telling the truth, and 100% of the time, it's grueling to come forward. Women are blamed, stigmatized, scrutinized, doubted, even with you. Her voice trailed off. I suppose that, in a weird way, if I had to be a victim, I was one of the lucky ones. I wasn't a drunk college student accusing another drunk college student about a 15-minute incident at a frat party. I was a 16-year-old girl whose one mistake was to accept a ride home in a Lexus SUV from a man who told me he was a 24-year-old realtor from Philadelphia visiting his grandparents for the week. Once I was in the passenger seat, he held a cloth over my face and repeated as necessary until I woke up naked on a twin bed in a pitch-black room with a pain between my legs because as much as I had been acting like trouble, as my father put it, I still hadn't done that. Not yet. I didn't come home for 3 years, and only when police killed my abductor. Charles Franklin was actually 31 when he took me, but what did I know? Grown-up was grown-up. So I was about as victim-y as a victim could be, but even with me, as Susanna said. My parents, the police, and my therapist all told me to avoid coverage of the case, but they didn't know how I used that laptop some victims' rights group had purchased for me to help catch up with my education. I saw the discussion board filled with comments from strangers rehashing every fact they could find about the case, including the neighbor's observation that she had seen me outside a few times and once paying for food at the grocery store. She said I looked familiar and asked me where I lived. I told her that I was Charlie's niece, Sandra. Why didn't she ask for help? Some of the true crime message boards wanted to know. Why didn't she tell them who she was? I was about as perfect as a victim could be, but even I could not escape blame. Susanna was still delivering her monologue. The public's first instinct is to disbelieve the woman because we don't want to admit these horrible things actually happen. So to counter that instinct, we good feminists take the position that we believe every single woman, every single time. And then the Rolling Stone article about the University of Virginia happens and it hurts us all. So I don't know what this woman's angle is, Angela, but I have to think there is one, because Jason didn't do whatever she's accusing him of. For once, I'm glad these cases are harder to prove than people think. Susanna had started out covering a crime beat in Miami after graduating from Florida State. How so? I asked. Whatever this woman's story is, it's going to boil down to his word against hers, and the prosecution needs proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Even if they have DNA evidence, the DA has to prove it was consensual. What? Why are you looking at me like that? We stopped speaking as the waiter arrived with our meals, steak tartare for both of us, the best in the city. The way you're talking about it so casually, I said after he had left. A trial, DNA, consent. This is my husband. We don't even know for sure what he's accused of. Sorry. You know me, I'm blunt. I meant in the abstract. I was trying to make you feel better by breaking down the worst-case scenario. But of course it won't go to trial. It's going to be fine. There's no consent to argue, Susanna. Jason told me that nothing happened between him and this Carrie person. As long as he didn't say that to the police. I assumed he invoked his rights to a lawyer. I didn't answer. She put her fork down, clearly frustrated. Jesus, someone as smart as Jason should know you never talk to the police, ever. He didn't see the harm. He works with the woman, end of story. It doesn't matter. And again, I'm talking in the abstract again. If he, not Jason, but if a man in that position said nothing, he could always argue consent if the police matched his DNA. But if they find DNA evidence after the man denied any kind of encounter, he's caught in a lie. Once again, she saw from my expression that she'd gone too far. But obviously, in this case, it's fine. If Jason says there's no relationship, there's no relationship. I made a point to ask what was going on with her. I hate it when people monopolize a conversation with their own problems, no matter how big they are. She told me about two stories she was working on. A woman had left her husband for a man she met on the internet, only to learn that the other man was an 18-year-old, not the 40-year-old executive he claimed to be. So far, the woman was standing by her new boyfriend, claiming that his deception was no different than shaving a few pounds from the physical description of an online bio. The second story was about the latest methods for obtaining passports, social security numbers, and other official documents based on stolen identities. People never get tired of following the cat-and-mouse games between white hats and black hats. Maybe your smitten lady can get a fake ID for her teenage boyfriend. While you're at it, save your research for me. If my face lands on a tabloid cover, I'm out of here. My attempt at humor fell flat. You're worried about being discovered, she said. It was a statement, not a question. I told her about the comment posted on the Pink Spot blog. I knew that girl back home. She'd say anything to put me in my place. Please, that website's got like 50 followers. Does that really matter? One viral tweet could change everything. Trust me, no legitimate media outlet's going to go there without your permission. If I have to call every contact I have in the business, I'll shut it down. Susanna had just insisted on paying the bill when my cell phone rang. It was Jason. I made my way to the front entrance and hit accept. Hey there, I'm about to leave lunch with Susanna. The police were here. They had a warrant. I felt the steak tartare churn in my stomach. Are you under arrest? No, it was a search warrant. Did you call Olivia? What are they searching for? Angela, we need to talk. 24. He had been having an affair with her, and the police had arrived at our house to collect a sample of his DNA. The reason he had summoned me home was to break this piece of news to me in person. Carrie wasn't merely a client contact. He had slept with her during that lunchtime meeting at her house last week. I didn't ask for every detail of the relationship, but it obviously wasn't the first time he warned me to expect a DNA match. I was the one who insisted that we tell Spencer. I didn't want our son to hear about it from some kid checking his iPhone at school. When it became clear that the matter wasn't up for debate, Jason wanted to be the one to explain it to him. We finally decided to speak to him together. We started by assuring him once again that his father was innocent of the allegations against him. Jason began to lay out Carrie's motive for discrediting him, but it was too much detail for Spencer to absorb. He knew we were both in his room, standing above him as he was perched on the edge of his bed for a reason. Something bad was about to happen. He didn't need excuses. He needed to know that his world was safe. The police will have evidence that links your father to this woman, I finally said. Physical evidence. But what she's saying about him isn't true. His confused expression was quickly replaced by disgust. You mean he cheated on you? Jason reached for Spencer, but he jerked away. Get out! Jason blinked, searching for words. My son, however, knew exactly what he wanted to say.
Get out! Get out of this house! Get the fuck out of my room!
I wanted Jason to argue to stay here until our son found some way to live with the news. Instead, he turned and walked away. I heard footsteps on the stairs. Part of me wanted to follow him, but Spencer needed me. He's not going to leave the house, Spencer. He lives here. We all live here together, and that's not changing. At least not right now. He asked how I could be so calm.
Why are you more pissed off? He cheated on you. He's ruining everything.
I told him that marriages were more complicated than he could understand. I was letting him think that maybe I had known, maybe I wasn't the duped wife after all. Obviously, your father and I have some things to talk about. But the number one issue right now is this woman. She's taking a consensual situation, an affair, Mom. He had an affair.
Okay, an affair.
She is taking their affair, and she is using it to accuse your father of a horrible, horrible thing. The most terrible thing one person can do to another. You understand that, right? And cheating on me, lying to us, it's not okay at all. It's awful. But she was an equal partner in that. She knew your father had a wife and son. And now she's making up a disgusting crime. And she's doing it out of greed. Your father has been trying to expose her company's corruption, and instead of helping him, she saw a chance to make him look bad.
I can't believe you're defending him. You're the one who follows all your little rules and routines so our life can be good and boring. And now he's blowing it all up, and you're going to pretend that everything's fine?
Trust me, Spencer, it's not fine. And this isn't easy for me. But, believe it or not, as much as Jason screwed up, he's actually still the good guy in this situation. This company, you just called him Jason.
I didn't see his point. You always call him Dad or my father.
He's that, too. Always, Spencer.
What if I don't want him to be anymore?
I'll change my name again. He never even adopted me.
You might be married to him, but I'm not.
Spencer, I am begging you. Please try to be on his side for the time being. If this case goes away, we'll talk about how to move on as a family from there, okay?
I'm not on his side, Mom. I'm on your side.
You promised when you married him it would always be you and me, no matter what. I said that to him right before we got in my parents' car to head to the wedding. I didn't think he remembered. He was still so young. And I would never make that promise if I hadn't meant it. But right now, Spencer, Jason's side is my side, and our side. If he goes down for this, everything falls apart for all of us. Do you understand that? He nodded. He had tears in his eyes, but I could tell that his acceptance of the situation was real, at least for now. I'd never given Spencer a reason to doubt my judgment. I was running on earned trust for the time being. I was about to close his bedroom door, but he had one more question for me.
Did you know about her?
That other woman?
Not now, Spencer.
I wasn't surprised to find the rest of the house empty, or that Jason's phone was turned off when I tried to call him. This is what Jason did when he was upset. He walled himself off. Colin knocked on the door about an hour later. I knew my entire face looked bee-stung from crying.
I'd ask if you're okay, but that would be pretty stupid, huh?
I was already half a bottle of cab down in the living room. I walked to the kitchen, retrieved a fresh glass, and split the rest of the bottle between the two of us from the sofa.
Is it your place? I asked.
He nodded. Again, Jason was predictable. Colin's apartment, across the street from Union Square Park, was where he usually went when he needed some space. He even had a spare key, supposedly in case Colin locked himself out, but I knew he'd used it the few times we'd gotten into horrible fights.
So did you know?
I didn't need to specify the subject of my question, or was it the object? I always got the two confused.
About this woman specifically? No.
But you knew something. You knew there was someone.
I wondered a couple times. He told me to mind my own business.
Sounds like a confession to me,
I said, taking a big sip from my glass.
Not necessarily.
I let the silence fill the room, hoping, or maybe nervous, that he would say more.
To be honest, I think I was worried he'd accuse me of having selfish reasons to pry.
Why would that be selfish? I asked, looking away.
To hope that maybe there were problems between the two of you.
I swirled the wine in my glass. The night before Jason and I got married, The three of us were drunk on Indian Wells Beach hours after it was supposed to be closed. Jason stripped down to his boxers and jumped in the water, leaving Colin and me alone by the lifeguard stand. He had told me that he was supposed to go to Susanna's party that night Jason and I first met. I could have met you first, but I hooked up with a bartender at Nick and Tony's and no-showed at the party. Guess you dodged a bullet and got the good one instead. We had never talked about that moment again. He says it started 3 months ago, I said. The affair. The word felt so old-fashioned. Colin didn't respond. You said you wondered a couple of times, I said. That doesn't sound like only the last 3 months. It sounds like more than a couple of times and for a while. As he continued to look at me in silence, it felt like confirmation of all my suspicions. When's Spencer done with school? He asked. Tomorrow? I had completely forgotten to make a last day of school cake, an annual tradition. I know I'm a shitty friend for saying this, but you're too good for this, Angela. Get out of here and take Spencer out east. And live with my mother? Shoot me now. Only for a little while, or I can help you. Colin had money, but not that kind of money. I shook my head. Colin was Jason's friend, more than mine, but he had always looked out for me. I remembered all those doctors he had called after my miscarriages. Then throw Jason out. He can stay with me. You don't need this shit. Let him deal with this on his own. He's the one who fucked some batshit crazy woman who would pull something like this as revenge. He said it was because of the company, that they're paying kickbacks in some third world country. Something like that could put them in prison. Yeah, he told me that too, he said flatly. That's not the revenge you were talking about, was it? Is there something else? He didn't say anything, and I imagined all the other reasons that my husband's lover might hate him enough to do this. I knew it was a mistake, but I went to the kitchen and opened another bottle of wine anyway. When I returned to the living room, I was slurring my words. Do you think Jason assaulted her? Are you kidding? Yeah, of course not. He's a fucking idiot to cheat on you, but no, he didn't do what that woman's accusing him of. I was replaying Susanna's words from lunch. We good feminists take the position that we believe every single woman every single time. I couldn't believe it was still the same day. Jason told me that this woman, I didn't want to speak or hear her name ever again, was supposed to help expose the company.
She obviously switched sides. The timing makes sense. She went to the police right after Rachel's complaint became public. She probably assumed that Jason was going down. Maybe she was even a little jealous of what she perceived as a flirtation with some intern. And so she went to the company, told them that Jason was planning to expose them, and came up with a solution to set him up.
When I had first seen her name in Jason's calendar, I had sort of suspected. But I had pushed my fears aside. Maybe if I had questioned him further, if I had followed him, if I had somehow stopped him from meeting with her that day. Instead, I now had to picture him driving out to her house, being with her only hours after kissing me and telling me I smelled good, giving her the very evidence she needed to frame him. We had cooked lamb chops together that night. I was hearing Susanna's voice again. Sometimes women lie, and it hurts us all. It's evil what she's doing, I said.
You've got to assume that a company willing to cut deals with warlords is capable of anything. But a lot of wives would say Jason's getting what he deserves under the circumstances.
Maybe I'd feel that way if it weren't for Spencer. I had been anxious about Jason's increasingly public profile, but Spencer was so proud of his father's activism. My son was only 13 years old, and he was already passionate about saving the planet, income equality, and a host of other issues. He saw Jason's work outside of the university as the stuff of superheroes. I can't have his father sent to prison for something he didn't do. I don't want Spencer to be the son of a sex offender.
Oh, Jesus, Angela. I'm so sorry.
Colin's voice cracked. 4 years ago, when I told Colin not to bother with Spencer's adoption papers after all, Jason had asked my permission to tell Colin why Spencer's biological father wasn't in the picture. I agreed, expanding the very small world of people who knew about my past by one. Colin treated me no differently once he knew. He never even mentioned it to me directly. I have to stay with him. At least until this is over, I added. Spencer and I were the only family Jason had. His parents had both passed away by the time we met.
The aunt and two cousins he had in Colorado might as well be strangers. If I left him now, it would look like he was guilty, right?
Honestly, yeah, maybe. But is that really why you're staying?
Why else? When he finally spoke, I could tell he was choosing each word carefully.
Jason doesn't talk to me about you, just so you know.
Okay. The transition was confusing.
But I asked him a long time ago about whether you'd had counseling for, well, you know, something like this.
Well, maybe you'd find it helpful now. Colin, I appreciate it. Really, I do, but one has nothing to do with the other. I promise. I could tell he wanted to say something more, but he just nodded. Then he added,
as long as you know that you can leave Angela, you have options. You'd still have Spencer, your mother, Susanna, even Jason would understand, and of course you'd still have me.
When I walked Colin to the door, I had this image of him hugging me goodbye, kissing me on the cheek, and leaning in to see if something else would happen. I felt myself anticipating it, wondering how I would respond, feeling justified to let it go further. Instead, he handed me his half-full glass and told me to call if there was anything he could do to help. The house felt quiet when he left. I walked to the pantry and pulled out everything I needed to bake my son a proper cake. I was still thinking about Colin's words 2 hours later as I smoothed the frosting. You can leave, Angela. Even after Charlie kidnapped me, you could still blame me for what happened. I only tried escaping once. After a couple of months, he told me that he wanted to let me leave my room, but only if he could trust me. I promised that I would do whatever he wanted. The idea of being able to walk past that bedroom door felt like freedom. He offered me a deal. When I heard the garage door close in the morning, I could try the bedroom door. If it was open, I could be in the house free while he was gone at work, but only if I promised not to leave. It seemed too good to be true, but I jumped at the agreement. I did it once, like a perfect little victim, noticing that there was no phone in the house and all the shades were drawn. I watched TV with the volume low, I drank soda whenever I was thirsty, I made a peanut butter and strawberry jam sandwich. It felt almost normal, except for my vigilance to clean up every stray breadcrumb and to scrub my dishes clean. And then when I heard the garage door open at the end of the day, I put myself back in my room, exactly as instructed. When he came to the room that night, he said I had been such a good girl. It didn't stop him from climbing on top of me, but at least he didn't hurt me. In the morning, I tried the door after I heard him leave and felt my heart drop. It was locked, and remained that way for another 24 mornings. Then one morning it wasn't. I was out again, and I was alone, and I thought I finally had my chance. I had been a good girl, I had earned his trust, and now I was going to get out. I went immediately to the side door, the one I was pretty sure led to the garage. My plan was to make sure he was gone and then leave through the front. I'd run house to house until I found someone to call the police. Charlie was hiding in the closet at the end of the hall. He grabbed me the second my hand touched the knob on the door to the garage. And then he really hurt me. I was like a rag doll, the way he threw me, how I almost floated in the air with each punch and kick. I'm not sure how long he left me in the room alone after that, but it was long enough for me to be so hungry I thought I might just die. I never tried to leave again. I never even let myself dream about it. I just got used to living there with him, earning new privileges. By the end, we were almost like a family, as twisted as I know that is now. He brought home a second girl, and I know how awful this is, but I was happy to have her there. I had a friend. No, she was more than a friend. We were like sisters in a sick, twisted fairy tale. She took some of the burden of Charlie's needs from me. And of course, there was Spencer. All of us together made Charlie feel safer, helping create a fantasy that maybe we weren't there involuntarily after all. We even got to walk outside a few times. As long as we took turns, one outside while one stayed home with the baby. We had to say we were sisters, his nieces, and we had to come back, or the other one and Spencer would pay the price. The few times I went to counseling when I came home, the shrink told me I had to work on not blaming myself. Blame for getting in the car, blame for being the kind of girl the police didn't look for, blame for not getting away when I had the chance. There's a name for it, Stockholm Syndrome. but I don't think that describes me. I did what I had to stay alive, and it worked. I saw Charlie fall to the ground when the police shot him, and like that, it was over. I was fine. If there's a syndrome that affects me today, it's survivor's guilt. I don't cry for myself. I cry for the girl I shared that tiny room with for nearly 2 years. She died, and Spencer and I lived. Colin had wanted to make sure that I knew that I could leave. Of course I did. I was no prisoner. Like always, I was doing what made sense, both for me and my kid. I wasn't going back to life on the East End without a fight. I'd deal with Jason once all this was past us. By the time Jason returned the next night, I had already heated up leftovers for dinner alone. He saw the partially eaten last day of school cake wrapped in plastic on the kitchen counter.
Shit, I forgot. Is she upstairs?
No, I told him he could stay over at Kevin's.
I'm sorry. I figured you guys could use a night without me, and then I spent most of the day at Olivia's office. She was grilling me like I was already on trial. I thought maybe she was padding her bill, but Colin says she's known for getting in the prosecution's head. He seems to think that she might be able to convince him not to charge me.
That didn't sound likely to me, but Susanna had said it was harder to get a conviction than most people realized. Spencer's history teacher called me today. She said some of the kids go to this camp up near Connecticut. They hike and grow their own organic food. It sounded a little hippy-dippy, but he'd have a couple of friends there.
Like an away camp? You hate leaving him with a sitter for a long weekend.
Well, things have changed, haven't they? He'll be away from the city, and there's no internet there.
Is that really necessary? If Olivia gets this taken care of,
that's a big if. And we don't know how long it will take. I don't want Spencer living like this. His teacher told me it was all the kids were talking about this week.
The camp?
No, Jason, you. You were what our son's friends were talking about the last week at school.
How much is camp?
3 weeks, with the option to extend another three.
How much does it cost, Angela?
Are you fucking kidding me? After all the money you've been making,
which goes to his school and to our mortgage and to taxes and to my agent and to running a business. Two clients have already dumped me, and I still have to pay the rent on our offices and paychecks for the staff. Do you know how much I had to give that defense attorney as a retainer?
Of course I didn't, because he hadn't told me. But now he told me he'd taken $50,000 from our savings account, almost all of it, as a retainer. If the case went to trial, we'd need to open up a line of credit against the house. Olivia estimated that it would be $300,000, plus any expert testimony they might need. How much is left? I asked.
It depends on what you count. I've got almost $1 million in my retirement account, but I can't touch it without paying massive penalties, and we have the equity in the house.
I knew it had been a mistake to extend ourselves to buy this place. Who owns an actual house in Manhattan, let alone in Greenwich Village, let alone a carriage house with the ultimate luxury of a parking garage? We could have bought a nice apartment with money left over to buy a decent house in East Hampton instead of renting in the summer, but this place was on the National Register of Historic Whatevers. It was significant. It needed us, in Jason's view. We had to lock it down, although it meant using his entire book advance as a down payment with an enormous mortgage to fund the rest. How much do we have left in savings now? I asked.
About 20.
I would have guessed three times that. The camp is only $8,500, $5,000 for 3 weeks. I never ask for anything, Jason. If you can spend $500,000 to prove your mistress is a liar, you can throw in a few more bucks to protect our son from the details. He's going. I expected him to argue, but he simply nodded.
I'm probably not supposed to touch that cake, am I?
I smiled involuntarily and handed him a plate from the cabinet, knowing that something in our relationship had changed. He needed me to stand by his side through this. He needed me, period. The following morning, the news broke. A woman, unnamed, of course, had accused Jason Powell of rape. The NYPD had taken a DNA sample for comparison. A criminal law professor from Hofstra was quoted as saying, "The DNA will be make or break, but let's face it, with a high-profile suspect like this, why would they ask for a sample if they didn't expect it to match?" I was in the kitchen an hour later when I heard a knock at the door. I looked through the peephole. The woman was about my age, wearing a white cotton blouse and navy capri pants. Something about her looked familiar,
Maybe she was a mom from school or a neighbor collecting signatures to block that high-rise proposed 3 blocks down. When I opened the door, she asked if Jason was home, then asked if I was his wife. I don't remember exactly what I said, but a story posted on the Daily News' website 2 hours later reported that a woman who answered the door at Powell's home, which he purchased for $7 million 2 years ago, said, "This is all lies," before retreating inside. Once it was dark, I went to the front porch with a screwdriver, removed the gargoyle door knocker by myself, and threw it in the garbage at the corner. As I walked back home, I realized it was the start of Memorial Day weekend. Exactly 7 years since I first met Jason. This wasn't a future I ever predicted for myself. 25. Jenny Mullen locked the front door of the house she had cleaned on Ocean Drive. She usually worked with her friend Lucy, but Lucy's grandson was running a fever and couldn't go to daycare, and Lucy's daughter had appointments at the hair salon, and her son-in-law, who was one of the best tree trimmers on the East End, still had his hands full, thanks to the storm 3 weeks ago. So Lucy was the babysitter for the day, and Jenny had cleaned this 5,000-square-foot home, the biggest house on her list of clients, on her own. She had returned the key to the hidden outdoor lockbox when the owner, Amanda Hunter, pulled into the round gravel driveway in her black Range Rover. Amanda stepped out wearing a fitted tank top and yoga pants, her arms sinewy and still tanned from last month's trip to St. Barth's. She was probably 40 years old, but worked hard at the gym and with Botox to look younger. "Hey there, Jenny. I thought you'd be finished by now." She would have left 3 hours before if Lucy had been there to help. "Sorry, I'm working alone today, so it took a little longer." "No problem. Sorry, I'm a little bit sweaty. Pilates teacher kicked my butt." She didn't look the least bit mussed to Jenny. "Oh, shoot, I forgot to leave you money, didn't I?" It was an ongoing problem with Amanda. "That's okay," Jenny said. "I always know you'll leave it next time." She didn't complete the rest of the sentence. "You'll leave it next time after I text you a reminder." Amanda was rifling through her purse now, pulling out random bills. "I think I have it, or most of it. Really, it's okay." Back into the purse went the bills. "I'll write it down so I don't forget. So are you doing okay with your son-in-law and this latest news?" "Oh, stupid me. I shouldn't have said anything. It's just here he is, like the perfect catch, and now this." Jenny assured her that Angela was fine and that things would be sorted out soon, whatever that meant, then made her way to the Honda Pilot she had parked at the far end of the driveway. "I like your new car, by the way," Amanda called out as Jenny climbed into the front seat. Jenny threw a final wave as she drove away in the car that Jason's money had helped her buy. Back home, she powered on her iPad, yet another gift from Angela, purchased with Jason's money, connected to the Wi-Fi that Angela insisted that she needed, but which Jenny rarely used. She typed in Jason Powell, then added the phrase "latest news," Amanda's words ringing in her ears. "NYPD investigating Jason Powell for rape," screamed the headline. According to the article that followed, law enforcement sources had confirmed that, separate from last week's complaint against Powell by an intern, the police department's special victims unit was pursuing a different woman's complaint that Powell had forcibly assaulted her. Jenny checked her phone. No calls from Angela. No surprise. When Angela first started dating Jason, Jenny worried in a way she hadn't since Angela was found and returned home. It was natural for her to distrust a summer visitor from the city, consorting with a local to prove he wasn't a complete outsider. Jenny, of course, had never blamed Angela for what happened to her, but the truth is that her daughter would have been safe if she hadn't been so obsessed with escaping her own community. Jenny would never forget the first time Danny found out where Angela really was when she broke curfew. In the past, Jenny had covered for her, telling Danny that she'd given Angela permission to stay out late or had forgotten that Angela had told her about a slumber party. But when a 26-year-old banker crashed his BMW into a stop sign on Cedar Street with two drunk teenage girls in his car, Danny finally saw a different side of his little girl. The banker tested positive for cocaine. Fortunately, no one drug-tested the girls, returning them home to their families. The first thing in the morning, Danny was down at the police station, insisting that the banker be arrested for kidnapping or reckless endangerment or some other crime for running off with his 14-year-old daughter. Some poor officer had to break the news to Danny. The banker had no idea he was partying with minors. The police found Angela's fake ID in her purse.